Well, why don't we begin?
Are you staying here?
2:30. Thank you so much for coming all the way up here. We really didn't know, because there wasn't really a chance to even kind of describe what this would be, and then also it was difficult to get here. So evidently you saw something, or everything else was full, and you wanted to come, so I'm very appreciative of that. I'll introduce myself just quickly. My name is Aaron White, and I am from Vancouver, British Columbia. I know everyone from Canada, or a lot of people from Canada say this kind of thing, but my family is from Ireland and Scotland. My great-grandfather was born in an Irish jail, so that's legit. You know, I'm very much in there. My grandmother was a roving gypsy from France who came across Canada and then somehow found a kind of Irish background kind of milkman in Edmonton, and they somehow got married. And as I was growing up, you could kind of see the two sides of this. My grandmother was this very free-flowing spirit who she loved going into the neighborhood that I live in and administer in now, the downtown east side of Vancouver. And she went into the prisons, and she would go and meet the girls who had been arrested for various things, whose family had just abandoned them because they were ashamed of them. Certainly in the 70s and the 80s, that was the thing. And so she would get them, you could do this at this time, she would get these girls released into her household and would bring them home. And then she would tell my dad, who was growing up at the time, you're not allowed to go into the basement because we've got a girl down there. And she did this for multiple women, and she was known as the Angel of the Courthouse. And that was a lot of my inheritance. And she began, I grew up in the Salvation Army, she began the Salvation Army's work in the neighborhood, which my wife and I have been ministering in now for the last 16 years. The neighborhood that we're from is called the Downtown East Side. And it used to be known as the 24 block, now it's about the 12 square block of Vancouver. People have heard of Vancouver?
Yes.
What have you heard about Vancouver?
Good coffee.
Good coffee, beautiful.
Is that the best place to Vancouver Island?
Yeah, this Vancouver Island is a little bit, you need to take a ferry there, and the ferry there is like, it's like a tour, you know, it's a cruise. There's dolphins and orcas that jump, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Vancouver, you can ski in the morning and you can canoe in the evening. Like, it is an absolute gorgeous place. Dave knows it well. Dave's a friend of mine from the downtown east side as well. And it's always in the top 3 to 5 of the most livable cities in the world, Vancouver. But our particular neighborhood is the place that some maps, they put the northeast southwest compass thing right over top, because they don't want people to go there. It's the kind of rougher area, and when I say that, that's not really describing it very well. Our house, we bought a house in the neighborhood, and we have, I'll give you an example, we have on our right-hand side, we have a brothel, on the left-hand side, we have a chicken factory, and kitty corner, we have a park that is really home to, how many is it now, about 100 homeless?
Up and down, I'd say closer to 200.
200 homeless folk who are living in the park, just kitty corner, and that's where we go and we pray every morning, and that's where our kids go and play, and where we take our dogs to go and sometimes get chased by other meaner dogs. That's just a little bit of our neighborhood. The highest rate of HIV AIDS in the Western world, the highest rate of intravenous drug use in the Western world, but we call it home. And I introduced myself in that way, talking about my grandparents and talking about my neighborhood, because it's actually a more biblical way of introducing yourself than the typical way that we do it in the Western world, which is what? What do you do? What's your job? Or what's your education? You know? And it's almost like we're playing a game of who's got the better job, who's got more education. You know? And it's sort of a very performance-driven way of introducing yourself. But if you look at the introduction of Jesus in Matthew, it's just a long genealogy, which to us just seemed incredibly boring and confusing. But to any Jewish person reading that, they go, oh, here's the story of Israel, here's the story. This is what they want us to know about the introduction to this person. And it would often be introduced by who do I know, who am I related to, where do I come from? That's the biblical way of introducing ourselves. And as you were coming in, I was asking you, where are you from? And that matters to me far more than what you do. So would you introduce where you're from?
I'm from East Sussex, originally in England, but I don't live there anymore.
For 33 years, I've lived in Hamilton. Anybody know where Hamilton is? Answer, it's in Canada. Anybody know anything about Hamilton?
That's not about the musical.
Not the musical.
Not the musical. It should be, shouldn't it be great? No, it's not. It's, how many of you know Sheffield in England? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Canada's Sheffield or Canada's Pittsburgh. And I don't know Sheffield very well, but I know Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh hasn't had the greatest time, and neither has Hamilton. It was a steel town. The bottom fell out of the Canadian steel market. It's a university town now, but that doesn't really help if you're a blue-collar person to find jobs. So there are parts of Hamilton that are lovely, and there are parts of Hamilton that aren't as difficult and challenging as downtown Eastside Vancouver, but they're challenging, and I don't. Interestingly, I do the opposite from Erin, because we went 33 years ago and we had two little kids and I wasn't involved in ministry. We chose a nice leafy suburb to live in, and I live about as far away from where I work and minister as it's possible to do and still be in Hamilton. So I have this rather sort of schizophrenic journey each day that I start from the leafy suburbs and I go to somewhere. Really, it's this a tree. It's on its last legs, and it's basically concrete and brick. So.
But it's the place when I come to Hamilton, the place where she's talking about. And I've been to your house, and I love her house. It's deeply warm and hospitable. But when I go to Hamilton, I go to the place that she's talking about. And that's where, not just because that's where I like to hang out anyways, but like I find that to be home. And that's a bit of what we're going to be talking about, is this idea of finding prayer and seeking the face of God in what some people would think of as unusual places, what has become normative to us in a lot of ways. And I would love to see it become normative to the church. There's nothing wrong with praying in church. That's obviously a good thing to do. But if you want to find a place, and this is really at the heart of 24/7 prayer, if you want to find a place where life and faith and prayer kind of meet together, you may really have to get outside the walls of, or off the grid, as they're calling it, out of the norm, out of the traditional kind of culture and setup. Again, it's not wrong to pray in those ways, it's good. But there's a lot of people who do not feel welcome to come into those places. I don't know if any of you have experienced this. I'm sure you have folk in your life who they say, I can't go into a church because if I do, the walls will fall down around me. You've heard anyone ever say that to you?
Yeah.
I mean, I've had so many. I'm expecting it all the time. And when we were meeting in a shelter, like a men's homeless shelter. And like, I can't possibly go into church. The walls will fall down. I'm like, do you know what this place is? This is like a drop-in shelter. There's no holy water, you know, you're going to be all right to come in. But they really still felt that. So even when we were there, we still had to find ways to go out of there.
So I didn't know you began that. My church began in the basement, actually in the back storage room of a homeless shelter, of the men's shelter in Hamilton. We had a question for you, and maybe you can just tell us, you chose to come to this session presumably because you wanted to learn something or because you had some questions. Could you tell us very quickly, because we're dead good at this, and we can just change on a dime what we were going to do. But what did you, this is a bit like Jesus, what did you come hoping to see? Or, you know, John the Baptist, I guess it was Jesus, now I think it's actually John the Baptist. What did you want to get out of this session? Just anybody just...
Yes, to feel challenged.
My heart is going to where people are who don't need Jesus, but how do we convince our congregations to catch the vision?
Right, we may not be able to tell you that, but
are you involved in helping other churches come help you do what you do?
Yes. So we can definitely talk.
Okay. Anything else?
I work in a Bristol prison, and my manager's a Muslim, and I'm trying to
Got it. Got it.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I catch that. Yeah.
It's like, how do you reaching out to the community that won't come to church or
yeah.
anything to do with the church?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even in the housing area around your
mm-hmm.
church.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah.
I work in North Lurgan, which is quite a private area, and there's a church there. But the difficulty is getting people to come there and feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of helpers.
Oh,
who
right.
want to come and be in that area.
So trying to get the church to come to a place that's
considered
a no-safe
area.
Yeah, that's it.
We've both got that.
Yeah, we can do that, yeah. Well, and we're not going to give you all the, you know, we're going to sort all those questions out, but we'll definitely touch on those things through some of the story and through some theology. Have anything else?
I'd love to know about some of the people that you've met that have become part of the walking alongside of being a really life of change, but they haven't moved on, they haven't become middle class Christians.
Yeah. I like that. That's a really
I can speak to that.
Yeah. So Dave's a buddy of mine. And we actually had this wonderful, so I'll start kind of a little story here. We meet in the mornings, I said in the park to pray. And in this park there's just lots of tents. And we've been doing this in the park every morning. 8 to 8:30 weekday mornings for about 8 years. We have a little liturgy that we do there. And so it's usually sometimes three of us, sometimes just one. I love it when I'm just there. I'm totally fine with that. Sometimes just 12 of us. And then people from the park will come by and ask for prayer. And they know the liturgy that we follow. And they know that it's, you know, when it's time to sing, they know when it's time to hug. We hug everybody all the time at the end. Sometimes that takes the longest to do all that. And Dave was with me the other day. It was a couple weeks ago, and we were walking back, and we just had finished our prayer time, and we were walking back, and a lady from the house next door, the brothel next door, came across, and she was just kind of challenging us, right in that moment. She just said, oh, so you're reading the Bible, are you? And she clearly wasn't in a good place. And we said, well, we just finished kind of doing some Bible and reading and praying, and she said, well, why don't you do something rather than just reading the Bible? And Dave said, well, that's the rest of my day. Like, that is what we're doing, you know. We spent some time praying, and now we are going and spending the rest of our day doing something. And then she goes, well, what do I do? You know, how can I help? And she looked at, or how can I be helped? And she looked at me, and she goes, have you ever used drugs? I said, no, I've never used drugs. She goes, be honest. Went to my eyes, I go, I have never used drugs. I haven't. You know, and it was kind of this challenging question, but then I've had that question thrown at me before, and then there's a quick dismissal. Well, you don't know. Mm-hmm. And then Dave responded. Do you remember what you responded with? You want to tell him?
Well, I didn't expect that. So I was an addict for most of my life, and I confessed to her that I knew exactly what she was going through.
Yeah.
And she asked me what to do.
Yeah.
So I suggested that the pipe in her hand might be causing her some of the problem. And
yep.
suggested she might want to put the pipe on, and she smashed it on the ground.
Yeah.
That was about as much attention as that she paid to us. She was distracted by something back across the street at the brothel.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that I will run into her again, because on the other side of the chicken factory is a whole driving.
That's right.
And I walk that street every day.
So yeah. So we're there.
I'm looking forward to seeing her again
and
engaging with her again.
So we're there, we're praying, and most of our leadership team, most of the people that we're working with, are people who have been in that neighborhood, have come up in various ways. Most of the leaders that we brought here to Belfast with us, because we really do believe in that. We believe, and I was sharing at the Leaders' Day a couple days ago, or yesterday, that we started by bringing a bunch of people in to kind of help minister. And that was great, and there was fruit from it. But they would then stay for about a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years, and then go off. And it was a bit of a stepping stone to the next thing they were doing. And it would just really break a lot of hearts in our neighborhood. And so we started just refocusing and saying, no, we're going to give our best discipleship, our best leadership development, our best ability to pray, and build church and build community, build life with our neighbors. And we're told you can't do that. It actually doesn't work. You can't build the church with the poor. And we just said, we don't believe you. And so, you know, it's difficult, but everything is difficult. All church is difficult. It sort of depends on what you want to invest your time in. I know that Mary Caldwell, who just came in from Beirut, I know you had a very similar journey with people coming to Beirut to kind of do a lot. And, you know, that feels really great when people come and they support and they're helpful, you know. But at a certain point, you realize I'm spending a lot of time investing in people who aren't here, maybe not going to be here, and I should be spending more time. So that's part of the answer there. It's how do we learn to pray with and do church with the people who are there and actually don't have the option to leave often. They're not going anywhere. You want some church stability, find people who can't go. You know? Prison is great for that. You're a captive audience. You know, you can't actually...
Depends how long they're there for.
It does. Sometimes, yeah. If it's a remand, it doesn't really work.
Our mind is too quick.
That's right. So I shared a little bit about that. Do you want to tell us about you at 541 and why you pray there?
Sure. So the thing that I'm part of is a cafe. It just looks like a cafe. When he comes, when Aaron comes to visit Hamilton and he comes to see us, he comes to the cafe. It's not in a particularly brilliant part of town, but once upon a time it was a bank building, so it's got great big windows and it's got some exposed brick and it looks quite trendy when you come in. The idea of the ethos behind it is that right in the middle, it's a big space, there's a big table, and the big table is there to mess with people's minds a little bit, actually. But the big table is there is to say that when you sit here, you do not know who you're going to be sitting with, because we want people to come to eat at 541. It's called 541, not because it's chapter 5, it's 541 Barton Street East. It's just the address. People ask me that all the time. I wish somebody would find it really meaningful. Actually, rather silly versus being better, but anyway. And so if you come in, the prices are cheap, because we have about 150 volunteers and a core of about 15, 17 staff. So our payroll costs aren't too high. The volunteers change everything because they're incredibly faithful and they keep coming. I have no idea why they keep coming back, but they do. And they know us, and they know our friends in the community, and it's like going to somebody's home when you know where they keep the sugar when it's run out for the coffee, or they know where the toaster is. Because you feel different when you go somewhere like that, don't you? Because it feels like you're at home, and it feels like that, I think, at 5:21. And the difference is that our volunteers aren't just people from, you know, the nicer parts of Hamilton, but they're actually our neighbours. So I've never paid for a snow clean. We get a lot of snow, unlike where he lives. I've never paid for a snow cleaning contract or a window cleaning contract because our neighbours do that for us. I don't pick the cigarette butts off the sidewalk. That gets done for us. I don't even match water out the herbs in our window boxes or our veggie community garden at the back because that gets done for us. Because doesn't belong to the staff, it doesn't even belong to the staff volunteers. It kind of belongs to the community. I mean, obviously, you know, I have to write the payroll checks and all the rest of it, but it's an hour. Our volunteers sort of say, why don't we? I love that. You know, why don't we do so-and-so? Why are we doing it this way? Well, we're doing it, I don't know why we do it. Good idea, well, how would you do it different? And so that sort of, we keep our prices low, we have a pay it forward sort of system, 2 jars of buttons, 1 jar's full of buttons, 1 jar's empty. If you come in and buy a button costs $1. You can buy as many buttons as you want, but they're in the jar, the other jar then for the next person to come in and put towards anything on the menu. You can have $5, 5 buttons a day. $5 is enough at the cafe to buy a meal. It's about £2.50-ish, I think. Yeah, and so people do. So in the morning, there's a line up for breakfast, and we supercharge the button jar from donations from earlier because there's a line of people in the community who want breakfast, but they're the ones that are also cleaning the sidewalk and the windows and minding out who's doing what outside, which is usually not great, and checking the back alley to make sure there's nobody around the back who's not doing well. And the funny thing is, it kind of works because you get these fancier people from other parts of Hamilton who drive for a start, to the cafe, but you also get the woman who was working her corner last night coming in for breakfast, or she'll come in halfway through the day if it's not going well, because she knows that it's safe with us, and we'll give her what she needs. And she, you know, she just needs to sit or call somebody, or if she needs us to call somebody for her, she can do that. So we pray because we have to, actually. I don't know that we could do it any other way. We pray because when one of our people is screaming for murder in the space out the front, and I've already called the police and they aren't coming, I need to pray because I need people to be safe. I need the customers to somehow miraculously forget what they are seeing, and that they'll come back next time and not be too freaked out by what's going on. We have a prayer room in the basement that our local 24/7 presence Go Hop runs. So there's prayer going on in our basement. We pray in the morning before work. We pray it's shift change in the middle of the day. We have church there on Sundays around the same tables that we eat at in the day, because we think table fellowship is for everybody, and it's where everything starts. So that's why what we do. But okay, so this is like you said, how can you get people to come into your church? I don't know if it's the same here, but in Canada, every single church has a public health inspected kitchen. Like, you've got a kitchen in your church, right? You have sort of coffee after the service. If you just had half a dozen people in, not even that, four or five people in once a week to make a meal with you that they could then take home and have, or whatever home was. I mean, I've got my next dream. They've been talking about dreams this morning. My next dream is our community kitchen thing. But if they came in and they cooked in your space, no strings attached, it's not church, it wouldn't be on Sunday, it'd have to be in the middle of the week, and you ate with them. They don't serve things to them, eat, do this thing together. It's only tiny, but food works all the time, as far as I can see.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, there's so much, just even in that we can unpack. So much that I want to touch on a few things. One is, you said you pray because you need to. And if you were there this morning, you heard him talking about kind of entering into that new level of prayer. And I actually believe that requires us entering into a space of life that we know that we can't take care of it. We can't manage it. That is actually what leads us into that new place of prayer. That if I can sort out, if I can find comfort for myself, then I don't require the comforter.
That's what you were saying about the ankle deep, the knee deep, waist deep.
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm at my
get into that place. And so that's not just a spiritual, I need to find that place in meditation. I actually need to find that place in my life.
Yeah.
That I need to go to that place where I need the Lord. And so that is actually one of the reasons why it's a good thing to pray and to go and be in spaces that really we don't offer us any kind of false comfort. It makes it quite stark. And we know that we need... I mean, I learned to pray, really learned to pray, in an RV in Tulsa when we were being hit by a tornado with my family. I mean, that will teach you to pray. Because, I mean, I could not sort it. I called a friend and I said, I think there's a tornado outside. He said, yeah, there is. You better get out of there. I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's outside. And my whole family was there. And we just said, well, there's nothing else that we can do. Like, we really have to pray here. That's it. That's the thing that will save us. You know?
Yeah.
There's nothing else. So I think we have. So that's one thing I think is so important in what Sue said. Another is, 541 is one of the only places I've seen that, I mean, from the outside. Now, from the outside, it looks like a seamless kind of melding of people from all kinds of different socioeconomic backgrounds, and it's not a place where the rich come to serve the poor.
Yeah.
That's actually extraordinarily important. Because once you establish that dynamic of some people coming and serving the others, once you establish that power dynamic, it's almost impossible to get rid of that. And in our neighborhood, and Dave, you can back me up here, in our neighborhood, you know, if somebody comes down with a van full of food, what happens?
A mob
or a lineup. Immediately, people get into a line. They know their role. Get into a line.
And they'll come back the next day and the next day.
And they know, okay, they're coming out. So you just get into your assigned role very quickly. And we often tell mission teams who come down and say, please don't come down with a bunch of sandwiches and go, we've got some sandwiches, we've got a little bit of Jesus, and we're going to go hand out sandwiches, we're going to hand out Jesus. And this sandwich is really the price that I'm paying to you to let me have 30 seconds of your time to tell you about Jesus. Now, what is that message about Jesus worth? The cost of that sandwich.
That's bribery.
Yeah, it is kind of like and so it's not wrong. I mean, it's not wrong to serve people in some ways, but we have to be so careful about that. so careful about those power dynamics. So when we tell people, when they come down, we say, please don't do that. Please don't actually assume that you've got a bunch of Jesus and there's no Jesus here in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We did. When we first came down, we thought, oh, we're going to come bring Jesus to the poor. And to our great frustration, he was already there. It was really annoying. Like, what are we supposed to do now? And so what we tell people now is come down, go, please go and find Jesus in this neighborhood and love him. That's actually the call of your life. That's why you were made, is to find Jesus and love him. And you won't, it won't be difficult to find him. Go find him. And that totally turns the whole notion of ministry around. And then when you're there for long term, you just start finding Jesus all the time. That's very significant. And then what 541 has done is they've created a very intentional structure and design to let that happen. And we have to be intentional about it. It does not just happen because we're nice people. What happens when we just are nice people, we don't think about it, we're not intentional, is we will just attract like and like. And we will just end up with people who look like us, who think like us, who speak like us, and especially who smell like us. That's what you'll end up with. And if you want to do something different, you have to be intentional about it. You have to really think it through. So they have thought it through. How do we do this? Not in, and in a way that actually recognizes the dignity of the people who are coming in and recognizes prayer at the very heart of it. I mean, it's very easy to do that kind of thing and then to say, well, we just want to serve people and maybe Jesus will be mentioned sometimes. No, like they're actually, prayer is right at the heart. Jesus is right at the heart of it all. But they're very intentional. How do we make sure this place is safe for our volunteers, for our neighbors, but also for the person who wants to drive in here? So the food is amazing. Like, it's top quality food, which is actually very interesting because most of the food served to the poor is not very good, right?
Comes from having worked in a shelter, though. So I worked in a men's shelter, and on Sunday evenings there would be a community dinner. Like, we would invite the community in, and polystyrene plates with the food sort of got... There's something about going with the spoon when it sort of comes off you. And fluorescent lights... And lovely volunteers who would come in and they'd serve you, and then they'd stand like this, watching you. It's incredibly intimidating. I hated it. And I had this little list of when I rule the world in my head. When I rule the world, it won't be like this. And that was one of the things it wasn't going to be like. So now we have they get called community meals, but because it's just for our community. But we hand out invitations. You don't line up. You people know, because we say to people on the down low, invitations are coming out this week. So the Thanksgiving ones came out just while I was away this last couple of weeks. And so they get, and they're lovely. They're beautiful. We get somebody with good design skills to design them, and they have them in their pockets, and we take their name because, quite honestly, at least half of them are going to lose those invitations. But they have it. It's a thing to have. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when they come, they have it, or if they do have it, it's all sort of disgusting and gross and put in their pocket and folded up a million times. And then they come in, and we turn the cafe into a beautiful space. We have candles, we have greenery, we have a photo booth. We have somebody who comes up and does a free photo booth for them. It's super fun and hilarious. And we get phone calls from people that we don't know saying, do you do a Christmas meal? We'd like to come and help. And I have to say so many times, that's very kind of you, thank you so much. But actually, no, this is really just for family. It's for the 541 family. And so we actually don't need any help, thank you. Because it's us, so the staff, and maybe one or two, maybe a few key volunteers who've been long-term on. And we cook and we serve, but then we serve one another. The first time that we did, the very first one we did, We worked very hard and we made this lovely turkey, you know, restaurant quality meal, and we served it and it was gorgeous and it was lovely. We had a musician playing, it was and lots of noise and chatter. And then I realised that we'd kind of been sitting there for ages, and I'd forgotten that we really needed to serve dessert. But I needn't have worried, because our community folks had gotten up and they knew where everything was, so they went round the back and they were, and Jackie said, no, just sit down, and so they did it, and then we all cleared it up together. And that was so different from what it was at the mission when I worked there. Mm-hmm. I think it's better. It's more dignified. And the other thing is that we don't stand, we eat. Like, I get ticked off if my place gets taken. Thank you very much. I'm sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, that's my part. Because Because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You choose way against it.
No, it's about killing that power dynamic. And so that's the intentional creation of space. That's, it's obviously a lot of work's gone into that, and it takes some money, it takes a lot of effort. You might be thinking, well, that's a bit much. A lot of donations, a lot of engagement. So that's part of the question, is that Sue and her team have created a scenario where people can actually get involved from outside the neighborhood in a safe way, but also in a meaningful way. And I love, she said to me once, she had some volunteers come down, and they were just very efficient, you know, very good at cleaning up things. And she just suggested, would you please slow down, because you're kind of ruining it for everybody.
I hope I didn't actually say it quite like
she was far more angry with them. more, you know, you're going too fast. You know, that pace is actually, that's not what we're looking for, essentially. I love that. You know, we're in a very efficient kind of get things done, but no, actually honor people. So that's the very intentional creation of space. But even then, and as I was saying, kind of in our shelter church, there were people who were like, well, I can't go there. I could not go into that space. And I imagine there's actually still some people who would feel, I can't go into 541. That's unusual space, right? So then what do we do there? Because that's... Jesus seems to have this thing. I was sharing this yesterday. There's this word, dei, which means had to. And it said, Jesus had to go to Samaria to go and meet the Samaritan woman. But he didn't have to go to Samaria. He had no pressing appointment there aside from her. It wasn't on his way to anywhere. Or it actually sort of was, but you weren't supposed to, as a good Jewish rabbi, you weren't supposed to go through that area. You were supposed to go miles around, so you didn't sully yourself. You didn't become unclean. If you went through that area, particularly if you went into the place to get food, which is where he sends his disciples, that's a bit of a comedy in the story that we miss. He goes in there, and he sends the disciples into town, into a Samaritan town, to go get food, and they must be like, Jesus.
It's doing it again.
Like, sending us into the place to go get food. Now we're all unclean, you know, because we're in a market of unclean food. You know, what a mess. And then they come back, and he's talking to an extraordinarily unclean woman, religiously. He didn't have to, but he had to. And he had to go across the lake to go and see the demoniac man. And he had to stop when he's on his way to go and do a healing. He had to stop because the woman with the blood flow touched him. He had to. There's something, there's an imperative. In Jesus' life, if I have to go, and I have to go to these places that are unclean, that are surprising. And he says multiple times that when it says Jesus was amazed, the only time Jesus was amazed is when he finds faith in people like the Roman centurion or the Syrophoenician woman. He's amazed by the faith that he finds in these extraordinarily, what we would think of, and what certainly they thought of, as unlikely places. And I think of, Philip had to go to the Ethiopian. And Peter had to go to Cornelius, you know, and Paul had to go to the Gentiles. There is something of saying it's not just about creating a space where we expect people to come to us. We do have to go. And isn't that a wonderful place to be framed? I love in Hamilton, again, there's the thing called the prayer truck they do every year where they park a truck.
We commission it first.
You commission it for
you. We've had this for years. So we rents a U-Haul. What did that happen here? Rent a truck, like... we rent a cube
big
van.
Box cube van, yeah.
And we put craft paper, like plain wallpaper, I guess, stuff tacked up to the side, and then we're going to put blankets and put cushions and stuff, and we're going to park it somewhere. But first of all, we drive it. We used to drive it to the mission when I was chaplain at the mission, and now we bring it outside 5:41, and then church that day is we get everybody to stand in a ring all the way around the truck, and we lay hand. This is street people, right? So they've learned. We've taught. I think they think this is normal church.
Yeah.
They can't go to normal church because we haven't taught them right. But anyway, so then we lay hands on the truck and we all pray very loudly for the truck, and they're the ones who get to go in first and check it out and write their prayers on the wall. And then we're going to park it behind a street youth outreach in the centre of Hamilton, and we have it open all day every day for it varies each year, but 2-3 weeks. And we just have a little sign outside that says need prayer, and people apparently do. And we have a fridge because it's very hot. We do it in the beginning of July with cold water in it, and you can write your prayers on the inside. And sometimes we have somebody there because there's always two people in the truck, and people ask for prayer for all kinds of things.
I want to come to the next commission meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
We should take
first week of July. It's always Canada. It's always the Canada Day week that week.
All right.
Well, we're actually having a national gathering in Hamilton in June, close to that, so you can just stay.
I'll stay.
Just stay.
Yeah.
Fine.
So again, there's an intentionality of we need to go to spaces. And again, this is not knocking prayer rooms and churches or anything like that. It's good to do. But we know that there are people who are just not going to go there. And it's not enough for us just to sit in the church and pray for them. Jesus actually does tell us to go. There is a missiological imperative to go. So most of the places in Canada where we've had our prayer rooms, I mean, we've had them in a slum hotel room, in 504 of the Empress, the Man in Hastings, in the downtown east side. We had a student there who just said, I'll give up my room. And we were supposed to pray in that room. And you had to get to the downtown east side. Then you had to go inside this bar. And then you had to go to the front desk and go inside the dodgiest elevator in the world that frequently broke down. So sometimes that became the prayer room. Because you just be stuck in it. Honestly, that's not a joke. Or walk up 5 flights of stairs with all kinds of people doing all kinds of things on the flights. And then you walk down to room 501 and you walk in the door and it's this little prayer room that we just painted and decorated, looking over Main and Hastings, which some people call Pain and Wastings, center of the open drug trade. And we pray there. And we prayed there. It was supposed to be for a week. We prayed there for 3.5 years nonstop, day and night. And everybody in the hotel knew 504. That's a room where we can go and we can get prayer day and night, whatever's going on. And most of the stuff that was happening, 2 a.m. in the morning, those are the most active shifts. The stuff is going on and somebody needs prayer and people would come. I remember we'd do 3-hour prayer shifts to keep it going day and night. And I went in one day and I would pray for 1.5 hours. And it was nobody came in. It was completely just on my own. And it was all the kind of like, just sit and be silent and soak in the presence of the Lord. I was just like full. Just like, oh, this is absolutely wonderful. And then it was like on the stroke of 1.5 hours, someone came in and another person came in. And then like a documentary TV crew came in. And then people, like it was bedlam for the next 1.5 hours. And I walked out of that room feeling like, well, I've got the same amount of energy that I walked in with. Because I was filled for 1.5 hours, and then I poured it out for 1.5 hours, and off I go. That was a space that was, it was not our space. It was in another space that people knew they could access all the time. And it goes even, we've done it in crystal meth labs, prayer rooms there. We have done it in a youth drop-in center that was all kids who, they were not churched kids. This was in Orangeville. They were not church kids at all. In fact, they were the kids that everybody in the town thought were the dangerous kids. They shouldn't, you know, they wouldn't really want them in church. But we said, we'll run a prayer room here. And we invited all the church youth groups. And the first time all these church youth groups came, and some of our kids came. And it was an interesting mix. And our kids were kind of really, they weren't sure about this at all, because it sort of smelled a bit like church. But the most dangerous kid in the whole town just caught wind of this, and he just wanted to be part of it, and he would sleep overnight to the point where we had to like put incense and candles around him because he didn't smell very good by the end of it. But he would go to the skate park and he'd grab his friends and say, we're going to the prayer room. They're like, oh, what? We're going to the prayer room. We ran it a second time. None of the youth group came, probably because of Daniel, this one kid. But the room was full the whole time, just of kids from the drop-in, because it was in their space and they had encountered something that no one was telling them how to meet God, but they were offered an opportunity to meet God. In a space that was already theirs. Didn't belong to the church, it belonged to them. And in that one, I love this story. I tell it a lot, but I love it. One church group signed up for one prayer shift. And it was a Bible study of old ladies who most of them have been saved for about 150 years each. And they they had been having their Bible study in their Presbyterian church for, I mean, probably 60 years, same time, same channel, you know, the whole thing. And they decided this week they were going to do it in the prayer room. And I don't know how they even heard about it, but they did. And they all came in to the prayer room, you know, clutching their bags, walking, because you had to go through the whole youth drop-in and the pool table and everything to get just loud music to get there. And just was silly, like, and then they got into the prayer room and they were safe. And then a whole group of my guys, rowdy guys, just come along and going, Aaron, we're going to the prayer room. And I went, no, there's a group in there. They're like, it's all right, we'll join them. I'm like, oh, no. And they just went in, and I just kind of shut the door and just, you know, I was a coward. And just let them be in there. And they were in there for like 45 minutes, and no one came out. They have killed the old ladies. So I just kind of peeked my head in to see what was happening. There was a ring of old ladies standing around a whole group of teenagers weeping. They're all weeping, and they're just praying over these teenagers who the only thing they wanted was like people to love them. And the only thing that these ladies wanted was to love. They felt like there's no other way to reach this generation, but in prayer, they could be there together praying. And that's when it really caught me. Like, yeah, this is something. And this is the kind of place where I want this to happen. And I just don't, I mean, maybe my faith is low. I don't know that would happen in a church. Great prayer can happen in a church. But that kind of prayer probably only happens in a space that belongs to the people, belongs to those kids. I really believe that. I believe that those of us in a place of power and privilege have to be really thinking, how do we drop those things? Because Jesus calls us. And not, again, from a place of kind of patronizing, not in a place that we need to go and just serve. It's that there's something beautiful there. Those ladies weren't just serving. They were receiving the gospel in that place. Right? They were receiving the presence of the Spirit of God by getting to pray with those kids. I love it. And so we pray in the park every morning. And a couple weeks ago, this is a very fresh story, a couple weeks ago, we had a really interesting interaction. But during the summer, we had said, we want to put a tent. There's a, I don't know, 50, 60 tents in the park. And we just talked to some of the guys in the tent. And we said, we'd like to put a prayer tent here. Would that be okay? Just something during the day that's open, people come and pray. And they said, that's a great idea. We'd love that. We'd love to have a prayer tent. Because they knew we came every day. But just for various reasons, we just couldn't arrange it. We just couldn't sort it out. So 2 weeks ago, my wife and some of the people here, they went to pray in the park, and some of the guys came by and they said, we've got one. Like, you've got what? Like, that could be anything. We've got one. Some people know. Hide it quick. We've got one. They're like, what do you have? Well, we've got a prayer tent. We've put one together. You know, they just noticed, like, we hadn't done it. We hadn't done our job. So they went and did it. And so they was in the corner of the park. And they said, it's open 24/7. And they didn't know our name. They didn't know what we were about. They said, 24/7, you can come and pray, 24/7. And so they showed us, and there's like this carpet on the ground and an old kind of really lame picture of Jesus that they got somewhere. And they said, you can just come in at any time and pray. We'll have a Sunday morning meeting. We'll do that, you know. So this is, I think, where we want to get. That's what I want to get to, is now it's not, I'm not running something for somebody. They're running something. So now, and it rains a lot in Vancouver, so now, when it rains, you know, we like praying outside, but when it rains, we just go to their prayer tent. They've got it set up. That's their prayer tent. I don't own that. And, you know, I don't brand that. That's theirs. That's, I think, where we want to get. And I know, I mean, you talked about prison. Bob, who was sharing this morning, there's a lot of work in prisons. And one of the things that really moves me, and maybe if you get a chance to talk to him or read his book, is he'll go in and he'll run these Bible studies, but his goal is not to just keep being the guy running his Bible studies. His goal is to find, like, who are the evangelists who are serving life in this prison? Who are the apostles who are serving time in this prison? Those are the people that I need to find and commission, and they will start doing the work in this prison.
I don't think that you want, I think, is reading the Bible with the damned.
Yeah,
I don't think he's got it. You've got it.
Yeah. And he's got a whole series of well downstairs called Guerrilla Bible Studies, which are all about how to run Bible studies in these places that really empower people. Because again, even our Bible study kind of matrix and our prayer room matrix and our church matrix tends to be, how do you do this for people versus how do you teach people to do this and give it away? Yeah. That seems to me the best way to do it.
I used to run Prison Alpha. Because it's quick, you could do it in a room off the range sort of thing. That went down well.
Yeah, and that sort of speaks to the question that you had around, like, how do you keep people sort of doing it and not kind of going off? And I think is a lot of that is just empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that is developing the people who are around you, and assuming, again, I shared this yesterday, but assuming that they contain within themselves every potentiality for ministry, every potentiality for mission, every potentiality for leadership. It just, it's going to be off the grid.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a friend. I was going to show her a video, but we don't have it right now. I met her when she was prostituting and was an addict, and she would come to our house And, you know, she'd want to talk about Jesus a lot. That's actually, it's really easy in our neighborhood to talk about Jesus. We don't actually have to put on any program. You just have to walk around or just be there and people come and talk about Jesus. So she would do that. But she told us later, she didn't tell us in the moment, she told us later, she once got so angry with my wife and I that she saw a knife on the table and she wanted to cut us. Because she's like, you're just not getting it. You're not understanding. You're not, you know, and she had this whole idea of what the church was and who Christians were. And a lot of it was true. But over the last, it's actually been longer now, over the last 12 years or so, she has come into a place of just deep faith and just always calling up, saying, Aaron, you need to pray for this, you need to pray for this, you know, always bringing people over, just anybody she finds, she'll bring them over to my house and go, this person needs prayer. And the person's like, I don't even know where I am. And but she's our evangelist. And she wanted to become a Salvation Army officer. And I just was like, really, I don't know if that's going to work. Because it's, like, I just don't know. I don't know if that's a really good fit, because there is sort of a structure and a way that, and I'm not bashing anybody in this scenario, it's just that there's a structure and a way of leadership that is kind of assumed within just the church generally. And I just knew she was going to kick against that in every possible moment. But I also knew there's an anointing of pastoral leadership and evangelism over this lady. So how do we do that? You know? So now she's actually, there's a place called Street Church where she has now become a pastor of this street church. And it just really fits who she is, and it's completely open. So I just think we have to be thinking in different ways, that the normal leadership structure, the normal prayer system and structure, the normal church ways of doing it, those aren't actually sacred.
No.
They're sort of efficient.
They're weird.
They're weird, but they are efficient. Like, there's an efficiency to it. There's a reason we kind of do it the way we do it.
It's weird.
It is. It's completely. No, it's not. It's not natural. It's not sacred. And so we just have to be. And it's not that it's wrong. It's just not. We don't have to do that. When you start to realize, oh, I don't have to do that. There's so much freedom to go. Oh, I could do like whatever. Like, that's so freeing. And yeah, there's going to be people go, no, you can't do that. And just go, well, I don't believe you. I think that you can. I think that we could.
We had, last Easter, on Good Friday, we've had, we've had a lot of drug-related deaths with the weird street drugs that are around now. And by Good Friday, we were just tired. So I said, well, let's have a service of lament on Good Friday. But we hadn't had one before, and I mean, I've done Good Friday services, but I wanted this one to be different. So we had it in the evening, and we turned all the lights off. And on this big table, the table that we usually eat around, I put just lots and lots of different sizes of candles, and I put on a poster thing for it, that it was just going to be a time to remember our friends who died during the year. We have a special thing in the, you know, a service each time somebody dies. It's more like a wake than a service. But anyway, so we've had those, but... and I wasn't sure who was going to come, and I wasn't even sure what it was going to be like. And I had some stuff to read and some names and whatnot. People from the AIDS network came, people from the community came, somebody came whose husband had died really recently, it was really raw. And I said each time somebody comes up, just light a candle as you speak or after you've spoken. And some people sang, and some people had bought poetry, and some people had sort of a Bible reading, and that was fine. And by the end, it was completely dark because of the time of year, and the table was just covered in these candles, and that was it. And we just went home. And it was the most beautiful thing we've done for ages.
Yeah.
We'll do it again. You know, when you find something that works, you can do it again.
Yeah.
But people just came and they bought their own stuff, their own way of remembering, and we didn't structure it really at all.
Yeah.
And I think you could have done that anywhere, but it was better that it was at a place where we usually meet for coffee.
And I would say here's the one thing that to kind of create the spine of whatever we do, or the design of it, is the life and the teachings of Jesus. We hold to that. Because this is not just about just do whatever you want. There is actually, Jesus sends us out to teach people about who he was and what he did. In the power of the Spirit, go and do. So I do think that that's a foundation. But then when you start to look at the life of Jesus, you sort of realize that he was kind of like that. He did things that people said, well, you can't do that. He goes, oh, watch me. You know, I'll do it. I just did it. How do you mean I can't do it? And then the early, you know, apostles would do things. And then there's three times it says the Council of Jerusalem that kind of called people back to Jerusalem and going, okay, now what are you doing? Samaritans are getting saved? What's that about? We need to go and send some people out to figure that out, what's happening there, and to go lay hands on them, which they weren't really supposed to do, go touch them to have the Holy Spirit. When Peter goes to Cornelius, they kind of call Peter in, they go, what? Like, what are you doing? Why did you baptize them? And he goes, well, I had no choice. The Holy Spirit did it, so I have to kind of do it along with them. And another time, kind of dealing with Paul's stuff, when Paul was going to all the Gentiles. What do we do? So it's always been there. It's always been that, you know, call back, what are you doing? But the Holy Spirit seems to be kind of pushing his people out, you know, missiologically, Christologically, out into places where Christ found faith. And that is still, I think, our call today. That's what I would hope people go away with. That there's a freedom to just try that. Has anybody ever been told you can't do that? Ever? Yeah, probably most of us have had that experience.
Why haven't we been trying to?
Yeah, well, no, that's the thing. So this is not actually about a rebellion. This is not about a rebellious spirit. This is not about, the church is terrible. This is about, no, actually the gospel is great. I have found most people, when they tell me, oh, the church won't let me do it, I'm like, well, how hard have you tried? I mean, maybe, but maybe it's an excuse. You just don't really want to do it. And it's an easy excuse to not do it. So I would say I got in a little bit of trouble for this, but when I was with the Salvation Army, I'd say, we don't really ask permission sometimes to do things. We just do them, and once it's successful, we slap the Salvation Army shield on it. You know, and people will kind of accept that. I think we should just try. I think we should have the freedom to try these things.
If it doesn't work, you don't have to do it again.
You don't have to do it again, yeah. And failure is good. That's, you know, fail often, and then fail better. But just keep failing. If you're not failing, then you're not actually trying. So let's just fail. Be okay to fail. Be okay to try things. You know.
Luther said that, right? He said, you know, sin boldly. He didn't mean don't do terrible things. He just meant that sometimes you're going to do things for the sake of the gospel, and it'll turn out a bit of a disaster. But do it anyway.
So what?
You have said that. You know, there were churches and there were groups who were like, let's come and help you. And you're like, so how do you balance their desire to help, and what kind of ways do you give them that are constructively helpful but
yeah.
So,
I mean, we have a lot of volunteers who come through the year. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is to not just want to come once at Christmas, but fly in, fly out, because it's not really much blessing either way. You know, it's just,
yeah.
It's everybody's working rather hard to make it some sort of weird experience for the kids. So we've actually stopped doing that. But we encourage people to come and do 1 4-hour shift a week,
okay.
At somewhere in the camp, either at the front or, you know, food prep at the back, or clean up when we're closing, or there's various other sort of things that we could use them for. Come with a friend, you know, or come with your small group. Sometimes we have what do you call them here? House group, house
groups,
church,
small groups.
Who will come at sort of to clean and close, so they'll have supper and then they'll help us close together. They think it's terrific, and we're like, I'm still here, because, you know, if I have to clean another floor, I'm done. But they think it's fun. It's great. Oh, I get to use a dishwasher. And so, you know, you can do it. We have we have other outlets for them. So we have like a little clothesline thing along a wall about that wide, and we have clothespins on it, and this new hats and mitts and gloves and scarves and socks, clean new socks, because that's always in demand. And we say to church, you know, ladies groups, can you knit? You know, could you put, and then we just put them up, and anybody can come in and at any time and help themselves to a pair of socks or a hat. And sometimes people come to me and say, have you got a scarf? I really want a pink one, or I want a, so I'll go down and I'll rustle through and I'll come up, you know, how about this? You know, it's lovely because I can just give it to them. We don't do clothes. Sometimes people will say, I've got, you know, all the piece that I bring, I have no space, but we have this. It's just, it's not everything, but it's something. It means that people have something new. I don't want secondhand stuff. I want it to be new, and I want
That's
it
right.
to be good. It's not dollar store stuff.
Recognizing dignity
yeah.
is really key.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then creating space, safe space for people to come. Safe for my community, safe for them.
Yeah.
Safe for them. So when people say, we want to come down, I say, well, if you want, come down, come to a week, come for a week and just like live in my house and just follow us around or hang out in our rhythm. We'll walk around the neighborhood. We're not going to put on a special program, but you can just kind of do what we do. And then, because exposure does matter.
Mm.
It does help. And then while we walk along, we're talking and getting to see. So that we had a Swiss family came and stayed with us for a couple weeks. And it was a bit jarring for them. I have to be honest. Like, the kids were a bit jarred walking around. And they just asked at the end, or after we did a walk around, they asked their parents, is everybody his brother? Because everybody would come on and say, brother, you know, and we'd hug each other. And so they just had this, like, what?
Very nice.
How are they all his brother? Because, and people go, like, they really think we're the thing, because you walk around and I know everybody in the neighborhood. And I'm actually quite introverted. I'm not extroverted at all. But I know everybody. And they go, how is that possible? I'm like, well, I've been here 16 years. If you don't know your neighbors after 16 years, you might actually be doing that neighbor thing wrong. Like, it's probably good to know.
Yeah, you do have to stick at something for the long haul, even if it doesn't work at first, you know? I mean, we have church on Sundays, and sometimes it's like, I don't know, 20 people, and I think, that's it, it's all finished, it's gone. I might as well give up and go home, we've done church, you know, and then give your head a shake. Nope. It's probably that the checks were just out and people were busy spending their money, or there was a better offer because there was a free meal somewhere else that they were going to get, so they want to go there. It's fine. They'll be back. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just keep being faithful.
Yeah. We have time for one or two more questions.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering about the cafe, because you said that, like, essentially you set it up and they own it. Well, I'm wondering now.
It's both.
So I'm coming from where on a Tuesday morning we have a lot of locals coming in. Most of those locals have mental health issues.
Yeah.
So
same for us.
We need. Yeah, I'm wondering then how, because if I think of the people we have to have a whole backbone of support for them to have, you know,
yeah,
tea, coffee, prayer, lunch, you know.
Well, okay. So we have folks. I'm thinking one particular volunteer. Her thing is that she puts ketchup in the little containers, you know, with the lids on. And she just does that, and she'll take a whole morning, and she'll do it.
Yeah.
She always does them in a triangle, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 high. That's all she does.
Mm.
So Catherine, you can't ask Catherine to do something else, but she does that, and it's her thing. And we have some people who, if they're really off their meds, probably we're not going to ask them to do complicated stuff, but most people can handle a broom. Might not give a broom to some person at home. but I mean, you know, you can use it. Just it's usually something. Even our most, you know, repetitive behaviour folks, who I find sort of a regular.
Do you have a structure behind that?
Well, it's
a
cafe. It's a cafe.
Yeah.
It's run as a cafe. It
yeah.
passed. We've passed all our public health stuff. We go on being inspected, so we have to be careful.
Mm.
So you know, sometimes I say, actually, Ed, you know, you have to wash your hands. All right. Or can you take your apron off before you go to the bathroom?
Mm.
Or actually, you know, before you get up for your smoke, can you take your apron off? And it's over and over again. And as a staff, that's what we're there. Yes, I'm there to make the best cup for coffee that we can, but I'm also just there to so that there is a safe framework for people.
Yeah.
People learn. Like, just because you're living on the street doesn't mean that you aren't able to do things. They are more resourceful. Most of them have got more smarts and common sense and survival skills than I'll ever have. And you know, if you say to them that it needs to be done this way, it will be done that way. My community people are the best dishwashing folks. If you've ever been in jail and you've been any good in jail, you've got a job in the kitchen, so you've learned dishwashing. If you live in a shelter, the best volunteer thing to be doing is kitchen work, because it's warm and you don't have to go outside. And so they're always the best dishwashers, and they're the best at teaching my nice from across Hamilton drove there people to do dishes, because they're quick.
Yeah.
You know, the other people are sort of putting one thing at a time. It's like, we're going to be here till doomsday if you do it like that. But
and dignity does actually require like saying no, having boundaries, those kind of things. It's not about just free for all. Like, and sometimes actually ministry becomes that. Particularly ministry with poor, it's like, well, we just have to be gracious. No, actually, the way I treat a friend and the way I treat someone I'm in a relationship with is sometimes I say, it's completely inappropriate. You can't do that. And there's sometimes people who can't be in certain areas, and you know, I've worked with and continue to work with Canada's most high-risk pedophile. But that guy's never coming to my house. That guy can never come to a church. That guy, he just can't.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out other ways to do that. And it can be exhausting. And his parole officer once said to me, is he worth it? Like, while he was sitting in the room. Like, is this guy worth it? And I had to sit and think about that for a second. Because it's really, because actually my association with him made me kind of, other people didn't like me.
Yeah.
So you have to think, like, it's about being intentional, but not immediately shutting down the possibility and undergirding it all, saying, and Christ died for him.
Yeah.
And so, what's that going to look like? And it doesn't all have to look the same way.
And we service restrict people. Like, you know, if you steal from us, and I can see that you stole from us on the cameras,
mm-hmm.
So like next time you come in, I'm going to say, Joe, you know, you need to take a bit of a break, right? A couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or and sometimes, I mean, sometimes I say, how much, you know, what's reasonable? What do you think? Because I'm cross, you know, I'm angry. Because don't come in here and steal. We'll give it to you for free. You don't have to take it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, it's 3:30, so we want to honor that time. If there's other questions, I mean, you can sort of catch us during the week, but I think we shot our shot, and there we go. Thank you so much.